Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello, Colorado, and thank you for joining us for the March 6th reading of The Environment, a collection of articles from Mother Earth News, Nature Conservancy Magazine, and the Magazine of the Sierra Club. My name is John. Today we'll be reading the following main articles from the Sierra Club magazine, From Catastrophe to Conservation Triumph. The new film, Wildlife, details the love story of Doug and Chris Tompkins and their historic vision for conservation. This was written by Drew Higgins. And our next article, written by Rebecca Long, Climate Fiction and Dune, Lost in Adaptation. Frank Herbert's Dune is a work of climate fiction, so why have filmmakers struggled to make the eco-plot clear? So essentially, we have two film reviews here. We'll get going with the first, From Catastrophe to Conservation Triumph. Wildlife opens with a woman and a choice. Give up or go to work. I'd lost the love of my life. I was seriously wounded, on my knees, said conservationist Chris Tompkins in the film's opening scenes as she describes the aftermath of her husband's unexpected death. A friend presented her two paths. You can mourn Doug for the rest of your life, or you can go to work. What are you going to do? Chris recounts. And that was a choice. Chris and her late husband, Douglas Tompkins, renowned conservationist, founder of the North Face, and co-founder of Esprit, had worked tirelessly to advance an ambitious conservation vision in Latin America. Rather than succumb to the grief, she resolutely fixes her mind to finish the projects that they had started 25 years ago. Through beautiful cinema photography, Wildlife tells the story of Doug and Chris's romance, of their pivot away from profiteering in the outdoor industry to protecting the natural world, and ultimately how the Tompkinses accomplished the largest private land donation in history. It is a tribute to Doug's visionary life and legacy. At its heart, however, the film is about Chris. Amid flashbacks of the couple's youth, their budding romance, and political battles to conserve Chilean and Argentinian wilderness, Wildlife's throughline is Chris's climb of Cerro Christine, a mountain Doug first ascended in 2008 and named after her, in the heart of one of the parks that had once been their private, protected land. Along the trekking journey, we watch Chris take in the sweeping Patagonian landscape with its craggy peaks, snowy glaciers, and verdant valleys. You can almost feel her spiritual closeness to her late husband in these moments. This is the farthest I've been inside this park. We never got on the ground enough. We did not really explore. We just worked, Chris narrates as she climbs the talus field. This, she says, is her way of saying goodbye to him. After he was kicked out of high school his senior year, Doug moved to California to scale Yosemite's granite walls. There he met Yvonne Chouinard, who at the time was metalsmithing climbing equipment to sell out of his car, a bootstrap enterprise that would eventually become gear and apparel company Patagonia. This slice of the narrative is less novel if you're familiar with U.S. climbing history and have heard once, or twice, or thrice, a retelling of the golden age of Yosemite climbing, when mostly young white men were pioneering the frontiers of rock climbing between the 1950s and the 1970s. No doubt much of their work was indeed legendary, as characters like Chouinard, Royal Robbins, and Tom Frost moved the sport forward in monumental ways. After films like National Geographic's Valley Uprising, 2014, however, it isn't a particularly new story. Doug and Chouinard traveled to Patagonia in 1968 with a group self-dubbed the Fun Hogs, and ascended a route on the iconic Fitzroy Peak, which they named the California Route. It was on this trip that Doug fell in love with the Patagonian landscape, and Chouinard decided to make clothing that could withstand the region's famously heinous weather. An astute observer might notice that the Patagonia logo features Fitzroy's silhouette. Chris and Doug met through Chouinard in the 70s. For the next 20 years, they would take equally prodigious yet different paths in industry. Chris pushed Patagonia to become an outdoor apparel titan as the company's first CEO, while Doug, after founding the North Face and selling it 2 years later in 1968, went into business with his then-wife, Susie Tompkins, co-founding the luxury clothing company Esprit. Wildlife illuminates several epiphanous turning points in Doug and Chris's lives. After nearly two decades at Esprit, Doug realized that peddling fashion at the expense of the environment was against his personal ethics. For Chris, there were a couple of such watershed moments. The first in 1993, when she left Patagonia, the company, and moved to Patagonia, the place, to marry and live a joint life with Doug, becoming his conservation co-conspirator. The second such moment is Doug's death. The film does not share the details of Doug's demise until 60 minutes into its 93-minute runtime. It is a vivid and difficult retelling of the kayaking incident that, in 2015, took his life. While kayaking a Patagonia lake, windy conditions built 8-foot swells that capsized Doug's C8 kayak into 40-degree water. He ultimately succumbed to hypothermia. It's hard to keep your eyes dry at this point in wildlife. My fiancé is a paddler and has journeyed across expansive lakes in northeastern Quebec, where getting caught out in high wind can spell a similarly quick death. I myself experienced my first boat flip in whitewater on an evening last November, a frigid time in the Tetons where we live. Once you've been in bone-chilling water with waves slamming against your face as you struggle for air, you understand how rapidly such conditions can steal a life. It was an amputation, not just a loss, Chris says after Doug's death. Yet, this big, audacious vision of Doug's was the thing that kept me in one piece. That was a life raft for me. She cuts agricultural projects that Doug was stringing along, even though they were not financially tenable. She makes some compromises, but not on the big stuff. When one of the potential parks is threatened, Chris puts it all on the line. It was all or nothing. We do them all, or we do nothing. It worked. Wildlife is produced and directed by another couple, Oscar-winning filmmakers Chai Vericelli and Jimmy Chin. Chin is a close friend of the Tompkinses and climbed Cerro Christine with Doug the first time in 2008, and with Chris again after Doug's passing. The duo captured 400 hours of footage over 6 years. Vassar Haley shared that she had wanted for years to make a film about a strong woman. Toward the end of Wildlife, we watch Chris and the Chilean president at the time, Michelle Bachelet, at the signing of a deal in which Tompkins Conservation donated 1 million acres of private land in exchange for the Chilean government's donation of 10 million. It was the biggest land conservation donation in history, and it was two women doing this and making it happen, Chris reflects. When faced with criticism from Chilean and Argentinian citizens and governments about the size of the Tompkins' land purchases, Chris labeled it a drop in the bucket compared to how much wilderness is being destroyed daily worldwide. When you consider that Chris and Doug had protected 14.8 million acres of Chilean and Argentinian parklands through Tompkins Conservation and its partners, in addition to rewilding many of these conserved areas with jaguars, guanacos, and other critical species, it's a pretty large drop. Our second main article slash film review for the afternoon, Climate Fiction and Dune, Lost in Adaptation, written by Rebecca Long. Since antiquity, writers have dedicated their literary works to family members, friends, lovers, and muses. Frank Herbert dedicates his sci-fi epic Dune to scientists who work in deserts. The book, which Herbert calls an effort at prediction, honors dryland ecologists wherever they may be in whatever time they work. The note also serves as a tip-off, the author's attempt to establish his environmental intent from the jump and make sure readers do not miss it. Dune is a modern classic, a winner of the Hugo Award and the Nebula Award, the two most prestigious honors in science fiction. The epic has sold nearly 20 million copies since its 1965 publication. Today, it is considered one of the first works of what critics call climate fiction, or cli-fi. It's easy to see why. Beneath the surface-level story about space witches and giant sandworms, Dune is a love letter to the desert as well as an environmental parable. The novel examines what happens when humans try to bend nature to their will and, as Herbert wrote in his dedication, predicts the ramifications of abusing a land for its resources. In addition to being an environmental allegory, Dune is literature with a capital L. It's a subversion of the hero's journey and a warning about the dangers of religion, as well as a sharp critique of imperialism. And this is just the first novel in a dense 23-book series. No one would accuse Dune of being simple, and that's perhaps why the bestseller has often been considered unfilmable, which has not stopped movie directors from trying, with mixed results. The two most popular attempts, David Lynch's 1984 adaptation and Denis Villeneuve's two-part blockbuster, the second half of which is being released today, employ wildly different strategies to make the labyrinth plot digestible. But notably, both downplay the novel's environmental message and treat the book's ecological themes as extraneous rather than essential. The omissions are a shame, since they rob moviegoers, many of whom are unlikely to pick up the nearly 900-page tome, of the opportunity to grapple with serious environmental issues on the big screen. Dune the novel is rich with ideas about climate change, geoengineering, human hubris, and desert ecology. So far, filmmakers have barely touched these ideas and failed to capture the ecological heart of the story. If you've never achieved the Olympian feat that is reading Dune, here's the story in a nutshell. The desert planet Arrakis is the lone producer of spice, both a hallucinogen and substance essential for space travel, making the world a contested geopolitical treasure. Amid an interstellar power struggle, protagonist Paul Atreides and his family are sent to the arid world to oversee the mining of spice. We quickly learn that they are unwelcome colonizers on a planet already inhabited by people, the Freemen, and the sandworms, which have a symbiotic relationship to the all-important spice. Throughout the Dune series, the Freemen and the colonists wrestle with resource scarcity and the desire to terraform Arrakis into a more hospitable place. But making the world a paradise for humans means endangering the supersized worms and, along with them, the spice. In Dune, environmental and capitalist interests clash and converge in the struggle to control the planet. As the tens of millions of copies sold prove, Dune is as gripping as it is lengthy. But in its earliest versions, Dune was not a novel. It wasn't even fiction. In his book, The Spice Must Flow, geek culture expert Ryan Britt explains that Dune was initially a newspaper article. Herbert, working as a freelance journalist, originally set out to cover government attempts to halt migrating sand dunes in coastal Oregon. The article never saw the light of day, but his research planted the seed for what would become one of the most enduring sci-fi novels of all time. The novel's origin story helps illustrate Herbert's environmental intentions, as do the author's many public comments on the book. In a 1969 interview about Dune at California State University, Fullerton, Herbert asserted that he had long believed that man inflicts himself on his environment, that is, Western man. But as Britt points out, Herbert started explicitly referring to Dune as an environmental allegory only years after his publication, playing up the book's ecological themes as the burgeoning environmental movement claimed the novel as its own. Readers in the 1960s understood Dune as a thinly veiled metaphor for the global demand for oil, an interpretation strengthened by Herbert's arguably problematic use of Middle Eastern culture and language within the story. Given that readers and book critics immediately pegged Dune as a prescient environmental text, how is it possible that film directors adapting the story for the screen have treated ecology as a mirror theme? In the case of Lynch's Dune, the minimizing is likely because the director was so preoccupied with being faithful to the book that the movie became overstuffed. There simply was not room to dwell on environmentalism. Lynch's work is famously abstract and menacing, and in his hands, Dune became a grotesque fever dream. The movie flopped and is widely considered incomprehensible. The film's inability to pick up on the ecological ideas Herbert put down is the least of its problems. In stark contrast to the plot-heavy Lynch version, Villeneuve's recent adaptation is sleek and spare. The 2021 first installment did well at the box office, proving that with better special effects and the ability to split up the story into multiple parts, it is in fact possible to successfully translate Herbert's convoluted novel to the screen. But while Villeneuve's version makes more of an effort than Lynch's to explore some of Dune's meatier themes, like colonization, it fails to nail the environmental ideas. During a press conference following the release of the first part of Dune, Villeneuve connected his film to climate change, saying that the book is a prediction of what will happen in the 21st century and about survival. You'll have to take his word for it. As Lynch did in 1984, Villeneuve does occasionally tap into the source material's environmentalism through visual storytelling. In one shot, villain Baron Harkonnen, played by Stellan Skarsgård, plots to overthrow House Atreides and exterminate the Freemen as he's submerged in a vat of oil, a subtle detail that could be interpreted as linking the fight over spice on Arrakis to the struggle for petroleum on Earth. In another scene, Paul Atreides, played by Timothy Chalamet, is stranded in the deep desert where he spots what looks like a long-eared jerboa licking sweat off its ears to stay hydrated. They exchange a look, each seemingly surprised by the other's ability to survive in the arid environment. The movie is interspersed with peaceful shots, like the ones of the jerboa, and sublime, stunning images of endless sand dunes. In this way, Villeneuve succeeds in showcasing drylands as places full of life and beauty, rather than sites of just desolation. A quick perusal of the movie's Rotten Tomatoes page, however, suggests that the adaptation's ecological undertones eluded most critics. It does not help that deserts are rarely the setting for so-called environmental movies. Films like Princess Mononoke and Avatar pull at viewers' heartstrings by depicting lush green landscapes under threat. Mountains, forests, and other worldly seascapes are often used in media to make the point that nature is in danger. Drylands, not so much. Of course, a film does not need to, and probably should not, bash viewers over the head to get a message across. But because audiences aren't primed to understand desert-set movies as environmental, Dune could have done a bit more sermonizing. Villeneuve clearly considers Herbert's novel an ecological story, but his adaptation prioritizes visual aesthetics and world-building at the cost of some of the book's core ideas. The environmental subtleties are so subtle that they get lost. In a 2021 interview, Villeneuve acknowledged that he just skimmed the surface of some ideas that will be approached deeper in the second movie. If so, he's got plenty of material. Trailers for the second part, though, suggest more explosions, not more ecology. The second half of Dune, the book, is weirder and more radical than the first. In the deep desert, Atreides assimilates into Fremen culture, and his desire to protect Arrakis grows. Similarly, it took time for Herbert himself to fully own his book as an environmental one, only after he realized readers were making those connections themselves. Perhaps Villeneuve's second installment will undergo a comparable process of maturation, as the character Chani, played by Zendaya, says at the end of Dune, Part 1, "This is only the beginning." And I think we can fit in this short article, "Women in the Wilderness. Sierra Club Outings has organized all women backpacking trips for 40 years and counting." Written by Amy Tobridge. The year was 1984. Ronald Reagan was in the middle of his two-term presidency, the Cold War was raging, and Sandra Day O'Connor had become the first woman appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Women around the nation were fighting to cement the gains made by the women's movement in the 1960s and 70s amid backlash and discrimination. With so much change in the wind, a few leaders saw the opportunity to grow Sierra Club's outings program by leading the first Sierra Club backpacking trip exclusively for women. While the outings program was founded in 1901, only 9 years after the creation of the Sierra Club, never had there been an outing exclusively for women. Among the visionary leaders who pioneered the women's trips were Letty French, Frances Renault, Carol Dienger, and Carol Hake. When Letty and Frances proposed the idea of a women's backpacking trip in the Sierra Nevada, they were met with some pushback. However, those in the outings program who did not understand the reasoning behind the idea soon fell silent when the trips rapidly filled up and a second and a third section had to be added to accommodate the demand. Carol Dienger, one of the pioneers of women's trips, says, "There is something about women being able to help each other in a way that is very positive. We are able to encourage and lift each other up and learn from each other in constructive ways." Martha Schultz, another leader involved in the early days of women's trips, adds that the women who attended were all there to learn. They were all so supportive of each other. When you put men into the mix, they tend to take over without even realizing what they are doing. In the days when women backpacking, especially solo or without men present, was a rarity, these trips geared toward women taught vital backpacking and wilderness survival skills, and more importantly, they empowered their participants to see that backpacking is something well within their abilities. As Dienger says, "If you don't try something, you won't find out how much fun it is and how much it can expand your horizons." The Sierra Club's female leaders knew how important it was to teach fellow women wilderness skills and show them backpacking was well within their reach. However, they did not expect how transformative and life-changing these trips would turn out to be for their participants. Dienger's daughter, Jenny Moon, was raised taking family trips with the Sierra Club and began staffing women's beginner backpacking trips in those early years. In 1986, Moon and Schultz led their first women's backpacking trip together and have since each been leading Sierra Club trips both in the United States and abroad. In 2024, this dream team will reunite once again to lead the Moab Adventure for women. Ursula Glick-Kelly, a participant on that 1986 trip, found the experience life-changing, and it instilled a deep love of the wilderness. Glick-Kelly has since joined the outings leadership team and will be leading Boots and Boats in Bend, a women's multi-sport trip this coming summer. Over the past 40 years, women's trips have evolved and expanded to include service trips, lodge retreats, multi-sport adventures, and of course, backpacking excursions across the United States. The first trips were mostly beginner-friendly and an opportunity to learn new skills. While this continues to be the case, today's trips also provide an opportunity to escape and relax in a beautiful environment without the burden of trip planning and preparation. In terms of the vision for the future of women's trips, leaders Dinger, Moon, and Schultz want to see the outings carry on and expand. A key component is recruiting passionate, adventurous young women to become volunteer trip leaders who can help continue this incredible legacy. For everyone else, the outings program strives to add more categories of specialty trips, catering to a range of different identities. That article fit in there rather nicely, and that is the end of our time. Thank you for joining us for the March 6th reading of The Environment. My name is John.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.